Welcome back to the Coaches Rising podcast. Today I'm joined by John Churchill. This was a deeply inspiring and meaningful conversation for me. We are going to explore today John's mission to develop a new contemplative system for awakening that's calibrated to Westerners, and also a mission to create a planetary dharma. And so we will talk about three important strands that John sees in our path of awakening and growing up in this lifetime. We'll explore the path of what he calls individuation, of healing, of growing up. We'll explore the path of identification, accessing our primordial identity or waking up. And we'll explore the path of initiation, the path of soul, of giving our gifts, the hero's journey. And most importantly, how do those paths all intertwine with each other? What isn't possible when they are not all included together? John is the co-founder of the Karuna School, which is a non-profit global classroom offering lifelong dharmic learning to people of all ages, and their mission is to raise human consciousness. John is a founding member of the Integral Institute, led by Ken Wilber, and spent 15 years in training and teaching with Daniel P. Brown in the Indo-Tibetan Mahayana lineage. He's received advanced training in attachment therapy, hypnosis, positive psychology for peak performance, and the pointing out style of Mahamudra meditation, and holds a doctorate in clinical psychology from William James College. All right, that all being said, let's dive in. Here's the podcast with John Churchill. John, I'm delighted to be with you today. In fact, I've been looking forward to this conversation a lot, actually. The things that I've heard you speaking about in the podcast and I've seen and the things you've written, you know, really speak to my heart. So I'm excited to be here. And how are you doing, first of all?
I'm really well. Thank you. It's a beautiful day. Been for a run and a swim in the lake. I'm up here in Boulder, Colorado. It's like Eden right now. We've had a lot of rain. It's super green. So I'm happy to be alive and really, really glad to be here with you.
Excellent. Yeah, nice. Well, there's so many places we could start, but actually I think a good place is to, you know, ask you about, yeah, your work in general. And in particular, I wonder if you could speak a little bit about how you are making sense of the times we're in right now. You know, it's been a topic on the podcast a lot, the kind of change we're going through. People talk about a time between worlds and, you know, maybe the breakdown of modernity and something emerging and the crises we face. And so I'm wondering if you could speak about how do you make sense of our times? And in particular, how is your work, which we'll get into a lot, how is your work responding to our times, or how is it a response to our times? Yeah, what do you feel like we need to do in a sense?
Well, obviously the meta crisis is complex, and there's all kinds of factors at play here. I think what we're seeing is the kind of karmic culmination of the suppression, if you will, of the interiors of subjectivity within our civilization. For, you could say, 2,000 years. And of course, as technology, we have this fourth industrial revolution coming online that applies so much pressure to our interiors that finally the interiors have to fight back. Our interior, the sacred world, has to fight back because it's being squashed and squashed and squashed by scientific materialism and by the power of the technology that we've unleashed. So I think that it's, in that sense, it's the return of the beautiful. Right. If we think of the good and the true and the beautiful, this is like the beautiful wanting to like burst back into our culture and into our civilization. So that's a dynamic. And then we also just have the nature of the need to evolve without the development of the interior, we're not going to be able to address the complexity of the problems that we face. So there's also like an evolutionary drive to grow up and to mature and to protect sacred world.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, I certainly resonate with what you're sharing there. And then, I mean, how do you, you know, we talked about the interior. How do you feel like we're being invited to kind of give space to the beauty, to the interior? I know you're, you know, involved in, you know, sort of discerning and bringing forth a contemplative system that's kind of calibrated to Westerners and the times we're in. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, what do you think is important in right. in us giving space to our interior and evolving mm-hmm. alongside yeah. what's happening?
Well, I mean, essentially what we're talking about is a revolution. Revolution in consciousness, but that revolution will affect all dimensions of our, you know, of our lives. I mean, we can point to the revolution in technology, but I think this the revolution in terms of human evolution is going to be a real evolution. I mean, part of the challenge that we face is because that dimension, the sacred, really has been suppressed and attacked in our civilization for a while. We have a lot of back work to do. Because if someone comes into therapy, they don't know that they've been traumatized and they don't know their own history, and they're wanting to address the challenges in their lives, you've got a difficult problem. Because yes, you can teach them tools to kind of address what's going on, but if there's a bunch of material in the past that's completely unaware of, that also has to be addressed. You know, so many people don't know like the history of the sacred in the West, right? The mystery schools, Alexandria, the Eleusinian mysteries, the Dionysian mysteries, how Christianity kind of suppressed all of the interior sciences. So unlike in the East, where those could stay as a part of culture, all that had to go esoteric in the West for 2,000 years. So, you know, the alchemists, the Rosicrucians, the theosophists, the ritual magicians, all of the things that we would recognize, we point to the East and we go, oh, wow, they have these amazing contemplative traditions. The majority of people don't even realize that we've had those in the West kept in secret for a few, you know, for 1,000 years. And we see this, for instance, in the research, like all the meditation research is on, 99.9% of it is on Eastern meditation, with no understanding that we have Western traditions. And frankly, as long as we have a kind of a fascination with Orientalism, it's safe, because it doesn't kind of rumble at the foundations of Western civilization. But people need to appreciate that our greats, you know, Isaac Newton, alchemist, theosophist, Boyle, Ashmole, all of these who are the great, well, Brits, the people who founded really science, these were people deeply embedded in sacred world, in alchemy, in meditation. And we've lost an understanding that that's part of our heritage, right? So part of the process is understanding and reclaiming our own indigenous kind of sacred roots. So that's part of, you know, when I talk about a planetary dharma, the project, it does involve like rediscovering Western esotericism, rediscovering and integrating that with the best of Eastern contemplative psychology, and then how that is integrated into kind of Western developmental psychology. So there are a number of streams that have to come to the table. And again, paradoxically, most of the Western ones are the ones that are the most hidden, right? That's the shadow, right? You project something. It's easier to find it elsewhere than it is to find it in your own home, because all that stuff got hidden. So that's part of the meta crisis, you know, is returning to our own roots and discovering what it is that we've lost, You know, one of the challenges that we had in the West with our science is when vitalism got split from science probably 300, 400 years ago, we've been pruning the development of science.
So what's vitalism like?
Well, vitalism would have been the understanding of prana, of life force energy in medicine. So acupuncture, right? So if you go back 300, 400 years, we had a rich vitalistic tradition of medicine. And there's been the fight that we see still today between mainstream medicine and alternative medicine. That fight has been going on for 2,000 years, right? I mean, in fact, you see that fight in the Inquisition, right? When they were burning women at the stake for using psychedelic medicines. It's the same battle that's been fought between those forces that are kind of interested in totalitarian power and control of our civilization, and those forces that are interested in sacred world and deep democracy, right? So vitalistic medicine, if that had been part of our science, as our science had evolved over the last 300 years, it would be a much more integrated medical science, understanding how the energetic systems interrelate with the biochemical systems. That gets taken out, then science gets pruned, and then you can just say, well, that's got nothing to do with science, all those quacks and, you know, over there, when in fact, what we don't realize is science has been shaped over the last few hundred years. That includes psychological science, chemistry, physics, you know, all of the sciences, really.
Mm. Wow, so many things I could ask you about this. I'm actually interested to know how what you see taking place in terms of the emergence and the acceptance of, you know, vitalism and mm-hmm. some of these Western, mystery traditions. And I think, so I'm curious about that, but I'm also curious, how would you distinguish the difference between, if there is, you know, between the Eastern approaches? I know you're also trained in, you know, Tibetan Buddhist mm-hmm. Meditation. Sure. I've got a background in that too. But I'm curious, how would you contrast that with some of the Western esoteric traditions that have been hidden?
Same. The deep structure is very, very similar.
Yeah.
It's very, very similar. What has been kept alive is because, let's say in Tibet, their whole initiatory system was supported by the state, rather than suppressed by the state. So that's, you know, leads to an integration of their deep phenomenological sciences, their meditative sciences, with in the language of the academy, right? So in the language of their universities, in fact, that was the primary language in their universities. We lost that.
Right.
But in terms of the deep structure, very, very similar. But because their systems were in the open, they were able to move a lot more people through their initiatory systems than we were. And they also, because they were essentially in retreat, right, as a culture, they were in retreat, they were able to really work out some of the finer dimensions that need to happen in a laboratory. But now that they've been worked out, and just the nature of planetary karma, and that vessel got cracked as the Chinese invaded, those technologies are now, you know, psychotechnologies and understanding are now slowly being integrated into our understanding of the human mind and sacred psychology.
Because I what caught me was when you said also that, you know, if we I can't remember exactly how you phrased it, but if we open to the Western esoteric schools, that could rock the foundation more. You know, I can't remember exactly how you said it, but yeah. I think it was like alluding to that maybe it's a bit sort of easy to bring in the Eastern ones. What could you say more about what you mean by that?
Well, okay, so if you have different systems to compare and contrast, you can see how what they're both trying to get at. Right. And it also enables you to see, let's say that probably one of the challenges with the Tibetan system is culturally, the culture was at a certain level of development. Right. So the culture didn't really was kind of at a pretty pre-modern level of development. If, on the other hand, some of these ideas continued to be matured in modernity and they were still articulating the same principles, you begin to understand, oh, that's how that mind would understand it. Also, that's how a modern consciousness would construct even the organizations that facilitate the educational journey, right? Like, so you begin to get an understanding by the more systems you have to look at, the more lenses you have to look at something, the more it begins to reveal itself.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, we can actually, maybe this is a good place to pivot into. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, if we start to look at all those systems,
sure.
What is the common, what might be the things we would want to include in a,
what's the deep structure?
Yeah, in a sense, you know, I heard you mentioned like trauma work, you know, shadow work.
Sure.
And just before you answer that, do you see these Western schools emerging now more? Do you think that's happening? Like they're coming back out into the open, being practiced more by people in the West? Are they still, you know, more difficult to find? Or?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. First question. Was around the deep structure,
yeah.
Right? Obviously, the deep structure of a planetary dharma, if you will, because we're human, is the deep structure of the human psyche and how it unfolds, right? And maybe you could say that falls into three main processes. Individuation, identification, and initiation. And those are three different kind of major transformative processes that need to be integrated in a lifelong journey. Right? So the path of individuation involves the path of cleaning material up and individuating from being fused with your childhood material, right? So that would include your traumas, you know, working with your attachment stuff, working with your early relational structures, you're developing and refining and strengthening the self structure, script pathologies, self-image work, you know, all basically a lot of the Western psychological work helps with individuation. And that was, you know, mainly that's why Western psychology and, you know, Jung was pointing to that process, that was a sacred process, that individuation isn't just, you know, it is a sacred process of becoming an individual, the individual seed that you are, and separating it from the dross that are the complexes that you want. And so you can becoming individuated, a unique expression of the sacred, is a particular dimension of what Western psychology has to offer us in modernity. And it's really, really important. It's super important because for us to accomplish this mission, we are going to have to learn to come together and work together. But to do that, we have to be individuals. If you want to build sacred organization from people who aren't individuated, that's where you get cult and not culture. You get culture when you have individuation, and you get cult when you have fusion, right? So that process of individuation is super important. And so many of the work that your coach, you know, the coaches are doing is helping people like become more individuated, become more active, more proactive in their lives. So that there's a certain amount of cleaning up, there's a certain amount of activity in that process of doing. So that's individuation. Identification is a process really of a waking up process of beginning to understand that there's a fundamental, deep, primordial identity to what it means to be a human being. And that's got more towards the being part than the human part. Okay. Like, and that's really where kind of traditional mysticism, you know, the via negativa, if you will, of transcending and including and of shifting your basis of operation to deeper levels of identity, that's where that identificatory process takes place, right? And then you have the initiation process. Well, the initiation process, I mean, you can think of individuation as related to sacred personality, becoming an individual, and identification is about spirit, and initiation is really about soul. And that is really about literally waking up into a different world. Like, not transcending everything into pure spirit, but actually, literally, you start to see that this world is not the world that you've been taught that it is. And that involves an education process that is also rechemicalization, right? So the body begins to mutate, the DMT, you know, psychedelic dharma work is really around giving you peak experiences of that initiatory process. But then there's the lifelong process that actually makes that a permanent transition. So you begin to have permanent access to those subtle realms, right?
Right.
That's a really important part of sacred duality. If identification is really about sacred non-duality, initiation is about being initiated into sacred duality, into literal sacred world. And it's an initiatory process, right? So those three processes ideally are fused into a single alchemical process over a lifetime. And of course, we often see people who specialize in one. We see some people who are highly individuated, and have no sense of initiation or no sense of soul or spirit, right? You people who are like completely, you know, non-dual realized, completely identified with the ground of being, no sense of soul, no sense of being individuated. And same thing with people who have kind of really gone deep into sacred world and, you know, extraterrestrials and extra-dimensional beings and all of that kind of stuff. And they haven't worked out their psychological stuff, and nor do they have a sense of the deeper mysteries of a kind of transcendence. So those are the three processes, and if we look at across the whole planet, we see those three, you know, personality, soul, spirit, those three processes at work. And so essentially, you know, when it comes to the project of building a planetary dharma, it's really about bringing together those three fundamental processes. And what are the best in the East and in the West of doing that? And then how do we build the lifelong learning academy that allows people to progress along that route, right? Then to address the second question, which was about the Western. So, you know, the challenge with the Western traditions. So by that, I'm talking about. So if we look at the transition that happened in the West from the Renaissance to modernity, one of the organizations built to do that was Freemasonry. So Freemasonry was built as a sealed initiatory system that essentially was initiating people into modernity as a way of protecting, and the initiatory system protected them against the monarchists and the papacy that was attempting to break into what was then the version of sacred world that was trying to be worked out from a modern frame, right? So you know, and within that worldview of kind of sacred European secret societies, we see, you know, a lot of esoteric physics, esoteric chemistry, but, you know, meditation practices, ritual magic, all of those kinds of things sealed up within Masonry and within other Western secret societies. So the problem with those systems is they also haven't been updated. And to update anything now, it needs to have a planetary perspective, right? It needs to introduce, it needs to be an integrated synthesis of, you know, all of the Eastern and all of the Western without like wearing the cloaks and the funny, you know, the funny outfits, right? So yes, the Western mysteries are still active. I think to some extent, because they went into secret, they have been, when everything, and with some things that are held in secret, then strange things can happen. So I don't necessarily believe that they are able to, they have building blocks that are useful for the project, but the project for the 21st century, which is really, we need a unified planet and we need to understand what it means to be a human planetary being. And that involves the integration of East and West. It's, you know, we've moved beyond, you know, Eastern and Western. So I think we're in a new time, and it necessitates the building of new systems.
Yeah, I mean that does feel like what's happening as well. I made a lot of notes. I want to come back to those three different streams that you articulated, but it does feel like that's the time we're in as well, where, you know, there was a certain hegemony in the, you know, of wet, like Western capitalist kind of thinking, which proliferated around the world, and, you know, certain cultures and ways of being were marginalized. And, you know, the world was pretty stable for a while, seemingly stable anyway, you know, but, sure. And it feels now like, you know, everything's being destabilized, and these marginalized ways of being and thinking are coming into the center, and that's a good thing. But it's, you know, it's also like we're trying to make sense of things. And where are we at in this process? I guess one of the dangers is we don't want it to be dominated by Western kind of thinking again, like, oh, we'll just incorporate Eastern. It needs to be, I wonder what you think, does it need to be truly co-created, you know, with indigenous communities, with Western and Eastern, you know, Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere communities of practice that can come together and kind of create maybe a coherent linguistic use that, you know, points to the direct experience that then we can all explore together, if that makes sense, rather than, hey, we've all coming in with all our different terminology, some of it which is, you know, very poetic or very specific Sanskrit terminology, but, you know, sure. Do we know? Yeah. So yeah, there's a,
yeah. So there was two questions here. One was around, where are we in this process?
Right.
Right. You know, where are we? And then the second one is like, you know, in terms of that prod, you know, in terms of the kind of, that planetary Dharma project, like, how do we go about doing it? Right. I think where we are right now is in the chaos phase. All right. You know, I mean, for instance, one of the challenges that we have in the West is we have issues from a suppressed past and issues suppressing the future. Right. So what do I mean by that? Well, in terms of suppressing the past, certain capacities that we would have had we lived in an ancient Europe and the mystery schools continued in Europe, the likelihood is that the kind of suppression that we had through Christianity on both psychedelic medicines and on sexuality would not have happened. And had that not happened, the degree of sophistication of our alchemy, of our psycho-spiritual alchemy, now would be highly advanced, right? So we're 2,000 years behind where we could have been. I think you just got to like get like what?
tragic,
and that. So that's primarily got to do with the initiatory side, which is access to sacred world, right? Like, DMT in the brain is like sacred sexuality is designed to secrete the hormones to bring online certain capacities. So when you cut people's access to that off and you don't educate them in what sexuality is understood as being for in sacred world, then you begin to dry up access to certain realms. So we have that problem. And so you're seeing the renaissance of psychedelics, which is really about opening up what was left behind in the past, right? And so there's that issue that has to be addressed with. And so, and then there's the issue around the future, which is more developed states and structures of development, because just opening up the past and having access, you know, talking to DMT elves or you know, beginning to have a much deeper experience of symbiosis with nature and getting a sense of the sacredness of the plants and the animals isn't also necessarily enough to help develop the sophistication of perspective to address the complexity of the meta crisis. So you need both, right? So to do that, you have to have really well articulated maps, but then you also have to have a really well integrated curriculum. So part of the challenge right now is we don't really have well integrated curriculum. It's like there's a bit over here and there's a bit over there, and the specialists over here and the specialists over there. We don't really yet have, in my mind, good academies that can kind of lead us through a multi-year journey, because this is not a workshop type thing. It's right. It's not a year-long type process. We're talking about having to engage in processes that are the same kind of duration that when we went through school, right? Like if you want real development and you want to see the real change that you see between my boy and my daughter when they're 7 and when they're like 14 and 21, you have to stay in a vessel, in a system that long. And so one of the challenges is we don't have those contemporary. You can do Tibetan Buddhism, but it's not actually calibrated. You can do, you know, so we, the challenge is actually bringing those pieces together to create the kind of learning journey and community building that allows you to build a guild. Like, you know, like if it's a similar kind of project to what the Masons were scratching their heads 400-500 years ago, where you have to build, you got to come together. We need an education system that we know that we can speak the same language, because even though we're all doing similar practices, if you don't get on the same page with a technical language, it can't evolve.
Right.
That was one of the advantages of the Tibetan system. It's like you have a very advanced technical language of interior science. And once you have that, then you can start doing algebra. If we're still farting around with terms, which is part of the problem with where we are right now, is everybody's like hanging out their shingle and we have 10,000 breathwork trainings and all this and that, and we don't actually have something that is bringing together, you know, that is integrated. So the thing about the project for a planet, yes, over 100 or 200 years, the process that you're saying, describing, will happen, where the indigenous, where the discussions that need to happen will happen. I don't think that we don't have the time or the luxury or the politics involved in that process, meaning that because of, you know, cultural appropriation and all of the challenges that we see out there in the world, we've had these ecumenical dialogues for a few decades. I don't know if it's actually got us anywhere in terms of actually developing path. In terms of the spirit of what you're talking about, absolutely. I think that as a Westerner, the value of our of understanding indigenous wisdom is that you can turn around and look back and see it in yourself. Meaning, we have our druids, right? I'm a member of a druid order, right? I mean, we have our history. If you see it in other cultures, we have it too, right? So that's not to say that understanding a planetary indigenous wisdom isn't useful, but the work that we have to do in our culture is make sure that we do that for ourselves.
Right.
Because if we don't do that, we're also not taking care of the psychotherapy for our civilization, right? We have to dig deep enough to rediscover and own our own indigenous roots, which, if you think about the human brain and its phylogenetic layers, 2,000 years is just a little, like, it's all here.
Mm.
It's all here. So, I mean, that's the task that I'm interested in, right? I think that the one that the kind of ecumenical process is really important, but I do think that we need to move forward with, articulating and building that path so that the people who need that education, who are positions of influence, can have that education as quickly as possible.
Yeah, exactly. Because I was going to say, when you said, do we have time? I mean, it seems like, do we have a choice as well? Do we have a time to, do that bigger project, but do we have a choice in not to educate people who are coming and asking and looking for this kind of education? I saw you write somewhere on your website about, I don't know where I've written it now, but leaders who are spiritually grounded, socially conscious, and strategically savvy, because like that's something I care about. Everything you're talking about speaks to me and I relate to in my journey, I was a meditator for many years, but I was frustrated because I was like, why is it not taking purchase in my life? And started to recognize that, there was a lot of unintegrated trauma. And, every time I would get off the cushion, the kind of psychological, the structure was not there for the realizations I was having to actually take root in my moment-to-moment experience. And so, and then, another point, I became frustrated because I felt like, you use that word drying up, I felt like, okay, if I'm only focusing on a kind of primordial awakening and individuation, there's something's missing, something is still missing. And I then went on a path of soul initiation, and felt the qualitatively different feel of those communities that emphasize soul awakening from some of the others. And I was like, holy shit, wow. Like this is but I was then quite, when you're in those communities for a while, then you're like, oh yeah, but there's also dysfunction here too. Right. Like,
exactly. So Well, so that's why we need, at Karuna, we are, that's the project we've set ourselves. There's no reason why we can't come together and build an organization and bring together teachers within the faculty that can hold that together. We need a Hogwarts for adults, right? And you're absolutely right. Like one of the real dangers in the West is spirituality has been psychologicalized.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And the hero's journey is not a fucking metaphor. You have to do something. You actually have to do something. Right. So the reason why, if you're sitting on the cushion, is a path, it's meant to take everything from you. Right. Like it's meant to be like in the traditional initiatory systems, it was like, are you willing to die? Why? Because you are going to die, mate. So like, if you're not willing to, well, then you've already got a problem. And then once you're willing to die for something larger, then we can begin to move forward and actually have an interior and an exterior revolution, because of the nature of non-duality and how the Bodhisattva path unfolds, There's a relationship between what you and I literally do with the outer world and how you literally unfold. Like, non-duality is literal. So what that means is the circumstances that are facing you and me in our work life, if we think that they are not connected to how higher consciousness is born, higher consciousness is being born in the rub of exactly what's happening. So if you're using your meditation practice as a kind of Zoloft for the soul, then of course it's not going to actually bring about transformation, because transformation involves like actually giving yourself to the path and giving yourselves to the unknown, which involves growing up and maturing and not just using your meditative practice to mindfully reduce stress, when actually we're in a stressful situation.
Right. Well, this comes to, I've got like a number of questions coming up. So what I appreciate about what you're sharing is as well is that, you know, I've found it to be very destabilizing to enact some of these technologies we're discussing. You know, they're potent and, they really can destroy you in it, or you can deconstruct yourself. And, the moment I felt that there was a shift from like I was doing the practice to suddenly the practice was doing me. And then that took me into some really difficult territories that ended up leading me into some incredible places, you know, on the other side, but were very scary actually at points. And so sure. I think what I'm trying to say is there's also, you know, this psychologization of spiritual practice can kind of make it seem, can sanitize it a bit and make it seem like it's, you know, it's just going to de-stress you and, you know, live a good life. But actually, this stuff really works. It's potent. And I've met more and more people who've been through spiritual crises. And I just want to weave in one other distinction and then just see where you take it, which is that led me into a big inquiry around the efficacy or the appropriateness of, you know, a sutric approach and a tantric approach. And almost like some of the contradictions I found in, you know, like what I wanted for myself and what these approaches advocate, you know, in a sutric approach, which is kind of renouncing, you know, you'll be able to speak into this much better than me. And I'm going to very overly simplify this in a way that's unfair, but, you know, sutric approach, which is kind of renouncing or detaching from experience and almost aiming to kind of an experience of no self. But on the other hand, you know, I was wanting this initiation path. I actually want to be a person who is deeply in touch with my emotional life and my 3.5-year-old daughter and the way she touches me and what's happening out there in the world. The world is burning. And, you know, this Dharma, you know, I want to play my music. I want to be of service. So I found this contradiction in those paths. And I get that there's some value in deconstructing the self so that you can, free oneself from the, being caught up in being identified with a separate sense of self and the, you know, it's the way it's reconstructing itself. But yeah. Once you get beyond that, it felt like there were contradictions in the sutric path. Anyway, I've said a lot there. Yeah. I think you get the gist of where I'm going with it. I'm just curious what you think.
Yeah, so let's just define sutra path and tantra path. Traditionally, sutra is like the path of no. Maybe tantra is the path of yes. Let's just put it that simply. So what we have to do is we have to re-understand what those two, what is the contemporary version of those. And we have to understand them as different phases within the journey. At the beginning of the journey, you have to come to understand ethics. You have to come to understand multi-generational trauma and its massive destructiveness, personally, interpersonally, culturally, in our planet. You have to come to understand, ethics, cause and effect. All, you know, you have to clean up, right? You have to kind of really understand and have a clear perception of the work that needs to be done and the healing part of it. So that's the what I would call the Hinayana, or the individual vehicle, the individual phase of practice, is where you've been wheeled into emergency, and it ain't appropriate to like give the person IV DMT just yet. Okay. they need to learn the basic. They need to apprentice themselves to understanding what the path is going to entail, to understanding the responsibilities that are going to be put on them, and to begin to mature and get ready. And part of even getting ready is, if you can't get ready and you can't have enough patience, then you should not touch those other technologies, right? So develop, you know, whatever the amount of time is to become mature, patient, ethical, responsible, and understand the job that needs to happen. Right, that's the first phase, and that's super important, and that would be the sutra phase, right? And if you don't do that, you're going to have real problems, right? So that has to happen. Then the next phase is then from that place beginning to grow into a deeper understanding of the universal, like, what does the grail serve? Who does it serve? It serves the planet. It serves all of us. It serves all beings. So that part of the process, the Mahayana, the great way, is an opening up and shifting your identification to a much more, to the unified field, right? To nature itself, Buddha nature, and to develop that sense of identity that is committed to the whole, because it experiences itself to be non-dual with the whole. And that process can take anywhere from a year to 3 years, depending upon the level of proficiency of the student. Then you're now ready for like alchemical work, right? Because now you have the individual discipline and you understand the responsibilities. You've shifted your basis of operation. Your fundamental motivation now is towards serving the whole. Then process practice, or what you call tantra, process practice, which is probably the best translation. Now, these are the processes of deep transformation and catalyzation. They speed process up, but they speed up the wheel, you see. So you have to get the wheel going the right way. Otherwise, if you speed the wheel up and it's going the wrong way, then the tech will drive you into hell. On the other hand, and this is the same thing with AI, with any technology. So process practice, you know, super powerful breath work, super powerful sexual yogas, psychedelic work, dark retreat, all of these powerful transformative practices, they will spin the wheel. But if the wheel has been set go the wrong way, and AI will be the case, it will lead the wrong way, and it will lead very fast to complete egohood, right? And what are the traditions they would call black magic, the Darth Vader move, right? Because those process practices are technique, they are technologies.
Are you placing like breath work and psychedelic work in a tantric kind of bucket, process bucket there?
Well, it depends how you're using the breath work, right? Like, you can use it to uncover, but there's all, and the same with psychedelics, but you could also use sustained ongoing breath work combined with meditative practices, like an inner fire practice and tummo practice, where essentially you're now working with a technical process of lubricating the astral body, so that the astral body can then begin to wake up and begin to kind of open and wake up into sacred world. Most of the people doing breath work are using it for kind of healing work and kind of bringing material up. But if you're doing breath work two hours a day, that's a different kind of process
right, as part of your practice. And of course, in the fuller curriculum, that's what it entails. It's one thing to do a little breath work once a week or once a month. It's another thing that you actually have a yogic practice where you're really, you know, driving the energy. But if you're going to do that, you need to know why you're doing that and where you're going and what the further curriculum looks like. So yes, those technique, when it's technique, it is process practice. Now, granted, there are process practices that you could use whenever with people, right? I'm not saying you shouldn't use psychedelics or breath work at the beginning with people, but further down the path, when you and I as a practitioner actually learn how to use the breath work yourself, where you're no longer going to breath work, but you are actually doing your own practice, or you're doing your own medicine practice yourself, that's when you're moving, you're becoming more of an adept and less of a, you know, less of a kind of, less going to classes.
Mm. And do you know, that characterization that I made of sutric and tantric, you know, renunciate and, uh-huh, and kind of, you know, a no path and yes path, you know, I'm just curious if you could say a little bit about what you think about what I was saying, where, you know, there's almost like in Tantra, I found an invitation to work more with the qualities of experience as they're showing up, rather than to, sure, you know, kind of like, for example, my emotions, you know, to even to go into the emotion, not to, I don't mean to go in it in a way that you're like, you're really angry, so then you suddenly start shouting and hitting people, but more like, you know, you don't kind of like, you know, observe the anger from a witnessing perspective, and then, you know, which can have some real value to it, but it's, you know, it's more like, no, I'm going to actually almost like go gaze, become the anger, and, you know, allow it to reveal its enlightened, sure, quality. Do you, sure, yeah.
Well, to do that yeah, process. So what? There's one version, which is you completely suppress emotion. There's another version where you completely vent emotion. The tantric approach, in order to be able to witness emotion, right, and to be able to transmute it, and what that means is in your direct experience to be able to have the depth of insight that you can see that what's arising in your experience is constructed, and therefore you can play with it as if it's a display. But to do that, you have to be able to have a capacity for insight. But to train the capacity for insight, you need a year or two or three years of not having too much mess, because you'll never develop the capacity for that degree of insight in the, as far as the curriculum goes. To learn insight at the beginning, you want to have not much aggravation, because you need to develop calm staying. You need to develop the capacity to have a mind that's still and calm. That's the first thing. Then you need to take that and be able to use insight practice to deconstruct and see that what's arising is empty. You can't do that if you're emotionally disturbed.
Yes.
So the sutra approach is what you would learn at school. Like, that's the beginning of the school. You learn in contemplative studies, you have to learn how to suppress in the beginning. That's what calm staying does. Because if you don't have the ability to control the mind, then you're never going to be able to do process practice. Process practice, tantric practice, is advanced. You can't, you know, just saying whatever is not tantra.
Yeah, yeah.
That's just laissez-faire. Now, there is something to be said for the freedom of whatever, psychodynamically, right? Like, if you've come from a suppressive background and you're learning to dance and fuck, well, that's great. But that's not what we're talking about. If you then want to then really engage the developmental process, you're going to have to develop those contemplative capacities for metacognition. And to do that, you're going to have to go into a laboratory, a quiet environment, to learn that, like you would learn any science, because it's a science. And then once you've learned and practiced it, doesn't take too long, but you know, it takes long enough to apprentice yourself to learn that skill. Then you can re-invite all of that material back. And now you can do alchemy, which is what Tantra is, right? So you, Tantra is alchemy, the ability to transmute one state into something else. And you do that through the power of insight. If you haven't learned the insight, you wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah, cool. That makes sense.
And yeah, so we agree.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah. And I totally get it. Because yeah, otherwise, yeah, you're just going to be, you haven't got the stability or the insight to be able to work skillfully with the transmutation, the alchemy, because you're just identified, you're all over the place, you know.
But you are right. There is some degree just for, in our culture of needing that freedom. But that's more from a psychodynamic, like freeing stuff up, than it is from a development supporting growing up processes, yeah. Right? Like, and we've got to differentiate the two because they're different.
Yeah, totally, totally. And when you said metacognition, just for people listening, that is being able to take perspective on your experience, like awareness of. Yeah, your experience, right. Basically.
Exactly. Yeah. So all contemplative, well, all developmental processes are driven by metacognitive processes, the ability to take perspective on something, right? Yeah. You take perspective on your body, and then an infant can control the body. You take perspective on your emotions, you can control emotions. You take perspective on the mind, and so on and so forth. So metacognition, the ability to take perspective on your experience, and how that refines and develops, that is the main mechanism behind all development.
Really good. And the question I want to ask now is almost like continuing, you know, in a way you're articulating a kind of path of practice here of where you would focus on and the next stage after that. And what I'm curious about is how you would weave the three paths you clarified earlier, you know, individuation, identification, and initiation. You know, do you see those as happening concurrently? In a way, I know we've already talked about, hey, you know, you want to start to do your individuation work first, or at least get that going, because then you know, you're cleaning up, you're integrating unresolved trauma. But I can imagine that, you know, like meditation practice can be supportive. For example, you know, the ability for me when I've done something like internal family systems with clients, for them to be able to disidentify from parts of them that are showing up and access a kind of presence that can be with experience, that's helpful. And that can be cultivated through meditation as well. So do you find those you said some amazing things.
This is a great question. So this is where we need the Atman project, in the sense that we need the building of a new organization with proper faculty, because traditionally that wasn't the case. However, the more we have an understanding of the deep structure of the human psyche, the more we can have a synthesis. And I'll give you an example. Psychologically, the very foundation of human psychology is really the attachment system. I mean, we could talk about coex systems from birth, but the attachment system. And the attachment system being how you and I and the listeners, how we all internalized our early caregivers. And that attachment system, that relationship, helped us internalize it gave us our sense of deep safety and security. It helped us internalize our ability to attune to our own nervous systems. So the ability that you and I have right now, and the listeners have, to feel what's arising inside, and your ability to attune and self-organize your own nervous system, that was internalized through the attachment system, right? So how you are relating to your own interior experience is highly defined by how well you were able to internalize what was there. And it's pretty well understood that most of the personality disorders are actually related to attachment issues. So this is the very fundamental basis of all development. And of course, the sense of safety that allows the unfolding of our development all the way up the stack. And if there's problems at that base level of attachment or the root chakra, if you want to talk about it kind of energetically, that affects everything further on, further up. So a really important part of individuation is healing that attachment system so we feel secure, so we can let go of what we're holding on to and actually become an individual, because we're going to end up holding on to something that we shouldn't be holding on to. So we all, you know, we all do that. Now, so that's from a kind of psychological perspective. Now, from the contemplative perspective, the source of samsara, of the deep process of cyclic activity, of getting lost, of confusion, human confusion, is confusion, fusion with the attentional system itself, right? Fusion with the attentional system. So if you and me right now and our listeners, our attentional system is what is able to focus on each other. And our awareness is what's able to be aware of the whole room. So I can see you, but I can also see the whole room simultaneously. Those are two different systems. The attentional system is locking onto you and awareness is already tracking the whole room. Now, to the extent that you're fused with attention, you become less and less actually conscious that there's a wider field. Yeah. Until most people are so blinkered that they're not consciously aware in every moment that there's a wider field. It's there, but they're not conscious of it. They're just in the blinkers the whole time. Now, that confusion with the attentional system is brought about from the perspective of the contemplative traditions through beginningless time of what? Of samsara, of what? Well, if we translate that into Western psychology, that is multi-generational trauma. When you become scared, you get your awareness becomes fused onto your attentional system because you want to know what's going on. And as that becomes epigenetically rolled over multiple generations of not feeling safe, then the default mechanism, even as you're kind of growing in the womb, is awareness to get fused to the attentional system because it doesn't feel safe. Because actually nobody really has a good attachment system. From a psychological perspective, you can say, oh, you have secure attachment. But if you go back to the traditions, in my mind, secure attachment is Buddha.
Buddha. So in a way, we've set the base. Yeah, our high bar is actually a low bar.
It's a low bar. It's the same thing in our medicine. It's based on averages. You want like average health? What? No, I want to live to be 100, you know, I don't want, right? You don't want to have average health. So what's interesting is the very structure that stops you from being able to be released from being fused with the attentional system. And the attentional system is the structure at the center of the self, right? It's your attention that's gluing yourself together in every moment. Now, those are the same structures, the same structure. If the attachment system is addressed psychologically and supports individuation and psychological maturity, if you understand that that also supports in identification and beginning to be able to shift into a deeper level of identity when that's relevant for you, those two processes can be actually woven together gradually. But what you want to make sure that you're doing is that you're not driving the identification process, which is, let's say, some traditions do, by separating artificially and not addressing the attachment system. If you address naturally the things that need to be addressed within a context of understanding what the other processes are, you can synergize.
Yeah.
But to do that, you need to have, you know, you need a more complex, sophisticated kind of curriculum. And right now, we have people over here doing that and people over there doing that, and it's not integrated. And good pedagogy involves like integration of multiple lines of intelligence through a curriculum. So yes, we can build a curriculum that weaves those three together in a way that hasn't been done before.
I want to ask you about how we might weave the third part in, but that's brilliant. Like, I really appreciate, you know, in a way you just articulated on a level of clarity for me, something that I'd sensed, you know, already through, sure. Hey, I need to do therapy because every time I, you know, either I'm meditating or I get off the cushion, you know, I get reactive, my trauma kicks in. I'm just curious where do you feel there are people in the world who are making, you know, who are at the edges of that integration? You know, I know you were a student of Daniel Brown, and he has, you know, he's written a book on attachment I've got downstairs with the ideal parent protocol, for example, as a practice, which I've tried, which is potent. I mean, what are you doing? What have you done that you found particularly effective in that synergy?
Yeah. Your first question was, who is doing that work?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the reason why I stepped away from working with Dan is that he actually kept them separate.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a few, in terms of, let's say, I mean, theoretically, our friend, you know, KW, you know, Ken Wilber, has done a lot to kind of, at least in terms of the mapping. You know, when I was a teen, this is going back a few decades now, there were three theorists that I was really interested in. Dan Brown and Ken Wilber and Almas, who founded the Diamond Approach. Although I don't, because Almas's approach isn't like strongly grounded in developmental psychology, it's really grounded in really good phenomenology. And it's also not really strongly grounded in some of the contemplative technology. I feel like that work, the Diamond Approach, had a little bit too much boomer processing for what we need. Like, we need something that is that really works fast, you know, that works fast. I mean, I'm sure that there are people out there. You know, I think part of our start in Karuna was to begin to build the organizational structure to then find out who those people are and then bring them into faculty. You know, that's a process in of itself, right? Getting our organization going, getting it funding, getting the wheels turning, getting, you know, people to come on board and to commit, because part of the problem with the kind of psychology of workshops and personal development is that isn't the level of commitment to start a revolution. Right. Right. So, you know, we have to cultivate a level of commitment to then be able to build what needs to be built. I mean, there are folks out there. You know, I mean, off the top of my mind, I mean, that's a whole other conversation. The other question that you had was like, well, what helps?
Yes. Yeah. What practices? What have you done? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, so I worked with Dan for 15 years. And for 10 of those years, we shared offices together. So I was his apprentice for 10 years and studied Indo-Tibetan meditation with him and also Western psychology, right? So I have my doctoral degree in clinical psychology and a master's degree in Chinese medicine. That's where the Chinese medicine thing comes in. I mean, if we look, you know, there's an integration on the psychological side. We have to come to have a really deep appreciation of attachment and that process. And of course, there's a number of different approaches out there, but that's like the most important of the psychological work, right?
Yeah.
Then you have the embodiment work, but of course, really embodiment work is going to come up against attachment, because what it is that stops you becoming embodied would be, you know, schizoid process due to lack of safety, right? So you want to work on the embodiment process. You want to work on the attachment process. Then, of course, you have like fundamental contemplative skills, contemplative practice, right? That's got to do with the waking up kind of process, if you will. And then you need really good maps to weave, you know, to weave all of that together. So what we're doing at Karuna is like putting that curriculum together. It's difficult to put it together all by yourself. It is.
Yeah.
That's what I found after 30 years of, you know, you're going to go over here and you're going to go over there. And I think that's worked for all of us in our own individual research. But I think at some point we realized, wow, we need to be able to actually do this in a better way.
A quicker way too, you know, in terms of bringing together the level of expertise needed in each domain to have a refined conversation. That I think that level of conversation needed to bring these disciplines together, you know, it's not something you can do after studying for a year in some thing, you know. You need the best of the best all coming together.
So that's part of the problem is people coming into the field who maybe have been done maybe 5 or 10 years or maybe 1 year, and then they're wondering why they can't do what you're talking about. I think it takes 30 or 40 years to be able to do that. And because our culture has a problem with hierarchy, and because everybody wants to like hang out their shingle, there is this kind of shadow of modernity where there's a, you know, we're not, people are resistant to find teachers and enter into long-term teacher-student relationships. So that is part of the problem. And if we don't do that, we're not going to be able to build a cathedral. Right. That's what the Masons got it right. You want to build a fucking cathedral? You want to build culture? We need to like work out. Yeah, we're going to have to come together. And so even the interpersonal practices, circling, authentic relating, you know, the whole of that domain, that's one of the technologies that needs to be at the table. And we need to bring the experts of those technologies together with the, you know, with the contemplative, with the psych, you know, and all of that gets brought into an organization and into a curriculum. I think it's doable. I mean, it's, if we can put a man on the moon, it is doable. The thing about the sciences, the outer sciences recognize expertise. Meaning, like, if I'm an engineer, like, I can't bullshit my way to putting a man on the moon. But the problem is you do a little bit, you know, you do a little training and a little bit of this and that, and you can bullshit. It ain't the same thing as being able to put a man on the moon, right? I mean, I learned this with Dr. Dan. Like Dr. Dan, you know, when he first started teaching just one retreat, and he then went on and did a level one, a level two, level three. We would have people come and do these retreats with us who had done 3-year retreats in Tibetan monasteries and got more out of a week with us than they did in a 3-year retreat, because the pedagogy and the engineering, the contemplative engineering, was really tight.
Yeah.
So part of it is, you know, the people in our field, coaches, therapists, you've got to recognize what your rank is, right? Recognize that and then support those who actually kind of outrank you. Because if we don't, like, there's no problem of doing that. The dark side, if you want, has no problem with hierarchy. And what hierarchy means is sacred order, right? So we have to find a way, a new way of coming together, getting over the Tower of Babel and building the kind of organizations that are needed to address this problem. And so we have to get out of the individualism.
Yeah. I mean, that's to be honest, for me, part of the worldview we're moving out of, you know, like, you know, with scientific materialism and Descartes and, you know, seeing the everything is mechanistic and reducible and emphasizing the hyper sense of what am I trying to say? It's like hyper individual, basically, you know.
Sure.
And I think that's part of the worldview we're moving out of. Where people are recognizing the interdependence of everything, and that even relationship is actually more, if not as important as the parts themselves. That and so that's, I think, you know, we're in that kind of curriculum almost right now anyway. That
dojo, we all are. That's right.
We're being destabilized by that, and
right.
And so that's why I feel like we need the technology and the curriculum in order to help us to, you know, orient to the world and make sense and thrive in the world too. It's like, because the change is happening, you know, and there's mm-hmm. a kind of, you know, it's the game is afoot, basically.
The game is afoot. We have all our coaches who are listening understand the importance of being maybe like of being able to hold in time where your client is within a larger growth curve and being able to hold that over a year. So what we're saying is we have to be able to build that for ourselves, as we're the ones who are providing that service for others, but we have to place ourselves within a multi-decade process and build the struts and the beams to support that multi-decade process. That, as we recognize the importance of that and the value of building those kinds of that kind of curriculum and pedagogy, which we're slowly beginning to recognize, like how many workshops can I do, right? Like, as we transition to another mode where it's like, oh, okay, this is going to take some time and this needs to be done well. And we need to be able to come together. This is how like the Masons worked, right? That you went through a certain initiatory process and then you joined the guild, right? Well, to the extent that we can come together, learn similar language and practice, and you know then that your brothers and sisters have gone through a similar process, and you enter guild where now you're a co-creator, right? And we need to kind of get to that level of culture. How can we, as those who are supporting transformation, get ourselves out of competitive culture and into more of a guild environment, right, where best practices can be shared and there's also continued service to building that lifelong. Once we understand that we're talking about, you and I are talking about, hopefully for us it's another 40 or 50 years, then we can start talking about what kind of institutions do we want to build. What kind of, then you can talk about finance, because then you can talk about actually how you raise money, because you can then, if we're on a journey that's decades long, now we can start thinking about actually building retreat centers, building laboratories, because we're not looking for the quick fix.
Right.
Developmentally, one of the hallmarks in development, and I probably, you know, and coaches recognize that as you move up in development, the sense of time that you're holding gets wider. You're moving from the quarter. Maybe you're thinking about the year, and then maybe it's, well, what do I want to do in the next 5 years or the next 10 years? Right? If it's all this little motor, that burns people out. When we start thinking about how are you and I going to journey together over the next 40 years, and what we need, it's a very different kind of question. And then particularly if we ask ourselves, well, what do our children and our children's children need?
Yeah.
One of the problems I see in the spiritual world is that the focus tends to be on our transformation and not on actually what do we need to build? How do we need to transform in order for us to build what it is that we need to build for our children? Now, when you look at the problem that way, it's a very different kind of approach than if you're just looking at it just in terms of first person.
Exactly. I think because that's what I was trying to get at before with the hyper-individual. It's like, yeah, you know, then it all becomes about me and my actualization, my fulfillment, my personal journey. And
right,
of course, there's a value to that, but I think it can entrench that sense of self and actually is actually painful in a subtle way. You know, the sense of service and commitment and fulfillment that comes from serving that larger whole of giving and the transformation that that can bring actually is probably what people are really looking for, you know? So
that is the, sorry, but that is, that is the real transformation. Meaning that if you do move into that next tier of development, let's call it the Bodhisattva or Terry O'Fallon might call it the Metta Aware tier, or, but in that tier of development, because the self has now become decentralized and expanded, your activity is all about being interested in building a new civilization and a new planetary culture. That's what the activity is. That's how the code of the mind changes, meaning the Bodhisattva code has to do with how do I think and what am I thinking about? So if you're just doing the state change and the code doesn't change, it doesn't happen. But if you change the code, the state is actually going to become very easy to begin to express itself because that's what the code is wanting.
And this might connect into two last little things that I wanted to bring up, which we won't have time to go into, but the Bodhisattva path, as you speak, or as you talk about that view there, I'm curious how that might connect with soul initiation, because yes, there's the Bodhisattva path in Buddhism, but I've found in that initiation path that at the very core of that for me has been, what does the world want from me? You know, rather than what do I want to create in the world? It's like, no, what is the world asking me to create? And so living a life of service. And then the other thing is like the heart, the role of the heart in that too, because I feel like that's a journey I'm on. The heart as a place of orientation and an organ of perception, you know, so this might kind of weave together like a few of the, you know, the things, because you talked a lot about the refinement of us. I wanted to ask you about the subtle realm as well, because that's a realm that I think has been in modern non-duality, not given as much, you know, it's been all about the path of the absolute. And
that's right.
I feel it's lacking and it's really essential. There's a lot of traction there. So, I'm not sure if there's a clear question.
This can get woven together. So within within a fourth turning view, within the view of a planetary Dharma, when we're talking about the Bodhisattva path, we're talking about the path of soul. Bodhi is awakening being. And so we're talking about the initiatory path. The Bodhisattva path to becoming a planetary Bodhisattva is about awakening to soul. You know, technically, you can think of the Bodhisattva as sitting right in the sweet spot between the absolute and the relative, right? That's the heart point, which you could also say that's the Christ. But of course, in Christianity, there isn't a path to becoming the Christ. In Buddhism, you're allowed to become the Christ, the Bodhisattva. And that midpoint between complete emptiness and complete form is the heart. So a lot of our discussion and dialogue has been like through the mind right now, because that's about orienting and getting the mind to understand where it is and what needs to happen. But the whole of the path and the way that the path integrates those three processes, individuation, initiation, and identification, is on the different levels of the heart. You can think of the physical heart, personality, the subtle body heart, the anahata, the chakra, that's the soul, and then the hridaya on this side, this is related to the absolute. This is, you know, the channel that leads down to the right. So the heart goes all the way across, right? The physical personality, the subtle soul, and the spirit heart. And those, of course, actually, as the heart increases, they all get integrated into a single center. So we haven't really kind of gone into like the phenomenology of these processes, but what makes it different is putting bodhisattva at the center, i.e. not trying to shoot too high developmentally, which is what some of the traditions do, is they go too high and not get right in the sweet spot. And that sweet spot is all about the heart. That's where we're able to bring all those interpersonal technologies that have been developed from circling and what have you, all of the kind of contemplative technologies, the psychodynamic technologies, they all come together at the heart. And developmentally, if we can get the planet to the level of the human heart, then we're going to be able to start trusting one another, understanding one another. So, you know, this is really about the technology of the heart. And the whole, from the point of view of the Buddhist tradition, my understanding is that those higher stages of the bodhisattva path are all about the deeper levels of the intelligence of the heart, both its cognitive intelligence, because the heart's field is a gestalt, right? The heart field entrains the brain. And because it's a kind of toroidal field, the more you're rested in the heart, the more your cognition will begin to be informed by those energetic structures. I think KW puts it in the sense like thinking holes, feeling holes, seeing holes, being holes. The holes part, that's all about the heart.
Yeah.
But we're talking about deeper and deeper levels of the heart mind. And if we are careful to really rewire, and this is about re-engineering these processes into the heart center, what we've discovered is that synergizes all of them and it speeds the process up. Not that speed is important, but it's an issue that we have to deal with, right? We don't have decades and decades and decades to get people going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. I'm glad that I asked about that. And I'm also struck by this synchronicity of the, you know, the things that were there in my mind and how they all fit together really beautifully. And, you know, we're at time. I want to thank you deeply, John. You know, this has been such a rich conversation for me. You know, I feel really lit up about what we've been talking about. And actually, I just want to say, where, you know, people listening probably want to know where they can find out more about what you're up to. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. So karunamandala.org. I'm sure you'll put the link in the
We'll link to it on the podcast page. I'll mention it at the start as
Thank you. Yeah. And so we have an ongoing programs, like kind of multi-year curriculum. And the next kind of two-year curriculum begins actually in 2025, but we have like day-longs, and also we're going to have a retreat this new year. So there are retreats that are kind of for the public, and then that then leads to an ongoing multi-year program. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So karunamandala.org.
Yeah. Thanks, John.
Well, thank you. Really enjoy the opportunity to be here with you and to share, you know, what it is that we're all doing. I mean, I don't think that what I'm sharing with you is much of what you and many of the listeners are already doing. I think the thing is that, you know, I mean, at least for me, it's been, it's 30 years now. So those of us who have just been kind of on this a little bit longer, you know, we're with you. You know what I mean? It's like we have, like, I think a lot of this has been worked out. Now the question is like, how do we all come together and build these kinds of educational processes for ourselves and for our children and for the future? So thank you.
Godspeed to that.
Yeah. Godspeed. Yeah.
Just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.